Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And today, we have the pleasure of welcoming two old friends.
Don't call them old. That's not nice.
No. Old is a modifier for friends. It's not anything to do with chronological age.
Yeah, sure.
Besides, they're both younger than springtime. And they get that reference because they're both music experts.
And we're old. Yeah.
Shall I introduce you in order of seniority? What should I do?
Alphabetical.
Alphabetically, here are John Burlingame, the preeminent reporter, author, scholar, teacher of film music, and the winner of the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for his wonderful book, The Music of James Bond, and also the author of a number of other books. The ones that I have a deep affection for is called TV's Biggest Hits. I go back to it all the time. You want to know who wrote the Andy Griffith Show theme? Want to know? You find out in that book. Our other guest today is Stephen Smith. Stephen C. Smith. To separate him from 10,000 others.
Yes. 20 of whom are writers, at least.
To be precise. And he's a four-time Emmy nominee, worked on, in its glory years, the TV show Biography, and Backstory, another great show. And he has a recent book, just published this year, on Max Steiner, called Music by Max Steiner: The Epic Life of Hollywood's Most Influential Composer.
Thank you, Leonard.
Oxford University Press, by the way.
And if it's good enough for them.
And I think you should mention the Bernard Herrmann book as well.
Well, I was going to get to that because that's how I first really became acquainted with Stephen. He wrote a brilliant, heartfelt biography of the great and famously cantankerous film composer Bernard Herrmann called A Heart at Fire's Center. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But one of the glories of that book, which you wrote when you were quite young.
Well, I was older than you when you started, Leonard. I was 19.
True.
But one of the glories of that book is that you did it in time to get to key people in Herrmann's life and career. And if you had started 5 years later,
you
would have missed out on those incredible resources.
We have a horrible game that we started playing. I mean, how old was I? 5 or 6? And my dad would start to talk about someone, and I would have to say D or A. And he would go, "Oh, he's been D for a long time." I go, "Oh, all right."
Yes. But A in our hearts.
Every now and then we get an A. And I go, "Oh, still alive. Who knew?" It's not a fun game, but it was very necessary talking about the people that we often are.
Yes. Well, happily, it's a company of A's today, talking about the D's and some A's.
I also say that all of our friends are like dwarves because everybody's got something that they're really good at. So I feel like in the event of an emergency, we've got one of everything.
Yes, it's true.
You need to know everything about this very specific genre of music. Don't worry. We have one of those.
And John Burlingame is also married to a film music expert in her own right, uh-huh. Marilee Bradford. And so they are a knockout combination.
She's also hot. She's a hot lady. And, you know, it's, you won on all fronts.
And producing director of the Film Music Society, which is the yes. film music preservation organization that's been around for a very long time.
Well, John, let me ask you a question I get asked with some frequency. Whoever made you starstruck, who that you sought out or interviewed or met, gave you pause?
Well, you know, when I first moved out here, which was in 86, and I was writing about television at the time, I used my new position to make introductions to and try to get to and interview all of my film music heroes. Mm-hmm. And I remember the day that Jerry Goldsmith, the famous composer, everything from Planet of the Apes to The Omen, said yes. And I remember pulling up to his house in Beverly Hills and thinking, I am a wreck. I can't even walk in this door. What am I going to say to this guy? You know, most people would be starstruck by Gregory Peck, you know, or Fred Astaire. For me, it was Jerry Goldsmith.
Well, I get that because he had real meaning to you. And yeah.
Lot of people. I mean, that's music. When they say music is the soundtrack of your life, that's not just a euphemism. It is.
And in my case, film and television music was the soundtrack of my life. Mm-hmm. And I'd been listening to Jerry Goldsmith's music as far back as Dr. Kildare in the early 1960s. And then, of course, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which has become kind of a second career for me between writing about it and producing albums of it and all sorts of things.
May I interject here that your reference to Man from U.N.C.L.E. is not completely irrelevant in this household because my wife, Jesse's mother, Alice, has had a pretty much lifelong crush on David McCallum.
It's intense.
Who played Ilya Kuryakin on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and who is still working.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
On the CBS show that won't die.
and good for him. For many years, he loved to say that his gravestone would say, here lies Ilya Kuryakin, who was once known as David McCallum. but in fact, you know, when Don Belisario hired him for NCIS, he developed a brand new career. And now more people know him as Ducky, some kind of a scientist. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Then knew him as Ilya Kuryakin, although to Alice and us, he will always be the Russian half of the famous duo for the UNCLE.
Well, and so should it be.
Right.
I'm not forcing my opinions or my memories on anyone else, but mine and Alice's are our own, and we like it that way.
Though yes. we did just joke that, Robert Wagner is on the show. And my dad was saying that he's the only one who can call David McCallum kid. Which I love. I love the idea of the two of them. The two of them doing anything.
Yes.
But especially the two of them on a hit TV show.
Yes.
So that young people have some idea who these greats are and were.
So, Stephen, at 19, how did you go about embarking on a biography of not just anybody, but a rather daunting figure like Bernard Herrmann?
Well, I'm lucky to have been born where I was and to know the people that I did. And my older brother, Wayne Bryan, who's 17 years older than I am and yet seems 17 years younger by his activity, he was a Broadway performer by the time I was 8 years old. We both grew up in a not very glamorous but comfortable LA suburb, Downey, California. And then Wayne found his way onto the stage in Broadway and was in Alice Faye's one and only Broadway show, Good News.
I thought.
I love that.
In New York or L.A.?
In New York on Broadway.
The sad end. Yes, it started with flaws and it ended as kind of a disaster. But Wayne had the enviable experience of spending a year with Alice Faye and John Payne, and that's a whole other story. But when he moved to the East Coast, he left behind for me all of his copies of a magazine called Film Fan Monthly, edited by Leonard Maltin, and books like The Great Movie Shorts and Movie Comedy Teams by Leonard Maltin, and many, many soundtrack albums. So I was in love with movies and movie music from an early age. And when I went to college without really a good idea of what I was going to do with my life, I was 19 years old, and Wayne came home for Thanksgiving that year. And I said, you know, I went to the library and I was trying to get a book on Bernard Herrmann. I hear so many amazing stories about him. I want to find out if it's true, if they're true or not. And my brother said very casually over turkey, well, if there isn't one, why don't you write one? And because I was 19 and didn't know what I didn't know, I said, well, I'll give it a try. And I discovered within days that at USC were two professors who were close friends of the late Mr. Herrmann, David Raxson, composer of Laura and other great film scores, and Norman Corwin, who I tend to think of as sort of the 20th century Walt Whitman or the other 20th century Carl Sandburg, and the great radio producer. And if they had, when I introduced myself and said that I wanted to write a book about such a complex, brilliant man as Herrmann, if they had said to me, forget it, you'll never do it, you're too young, I probably would have said, you know, you're right, and walked away. To my amazement, David, the first that I broached this with, said, well, that sounds like a very good idea. I'll put you in touch with Miklos Rocha and John Houseman. And he started naming these names. And sure enough, I did. And as soon as I had three or four of those names under my belt, I was getting phone calls from just about everyone. And that was a glorious 8-year odyssey of traveling to London. I sort of finagled my way into an international studies program, partly because Bernard Herrmann's widow, Norma, was British. And Benny spent his last years living in England, so all of his papers were still there. And Norma not only agreed to help me on the project, but I virtually moved into her home with her second husband. She took me in like a son, and she remains. Sadly, my mother passed away a number of years ago, so Norma, Bernard Herrmann's widow, has pretty much become my mom, and it was a wonderful experience.
And just for an asterisk here, if the name Bernard Herrmann is not ringing a loud gong,
then turn the show off. You don't deserve it.
No.
I'll just name two of his credentials, okay? See if you like these two. Citizen Kane, Taxi Driver.
And you've just named the Alpha and Omega. Citizen Kane was his first movie. And Taxi Driver was his last. He wrote his first at age 29. He wrote his last at age 64 and passed away the night that he finished work on it. So that's a pro.
Not to mention all those Hitchcock pictures in the middle.
That middle is pretty thick. You can spend a goodly amount of time discussing all of the wonderful work he did. And what a rich subject you chose.
Well, I was fortunate that certainly Bernard Herrmann, who was unique among composers of the mid-20th century in Hollywood, he chose all of his projects. He was never a staff composer, that he had such excellent taste and that he wasn't averse to scoring genre films, the kind of movies that even a Max Steiner might have turned down, things like the Ray Harryhausen movies of the 50s and 60s, or movies like Psycho, that in its day were considered really almost too edgy to be made. If it hadn't been for Hitchcock, that film certainly would not have been made. And Herrmann really embraced those kinds of darker projects. He had a dark side and also a very light side. And for all the legendary and mostly true stories about his explosiveness and combativeness, I discovered that he was an extremely sensitive man who knew as much as most professors do about poetry and painting, and was incredibly articulate, a brilliant writer about music, which, as we all know, is not an easy subject to write about, and so rich in his complexities that he was a great biographical subject. And he worked with and or offended just about everyone that lived during his lifetime, so it gave me a good excuse to call people up.
Now, even people who know nothing about movie music, I mean, almost nothing, know those screeching violins from the shower scene in Psycho. He invented a piece of music, or a music cue, as it's referred to, that has been imitated, ripped off, become part of the pop culture.
Yes, one of the few reasons I think it's good that he passed away when he did, far too young in 1975, is he would have been so infuriated, I think, by the many ripoffs of his score starting the very next year. And I think it's also a great cue to mention for Herman, because it sort of typifies his approach to movies. Hitchcock, in having him score Psycho, said, "Do whatever you want with a score, only please do not write any music for the shower scene." and Herman did not do it as an actor. Act of defiance. He simply felt that, well, I have a good idea for this. And he, on the day of the scoring, and in those old days, directors and producers did not hear a score really until they went to the recording session, and there wasn't much they could do about it. Benny was recording the score, and Hitchcock walked in, and Herman said tactfully, "By the way, Hitch, I did write some music for the shower scene, and of course you don't need to use it, but may I play it for you? We already recorded it." It was played back, and Hitchcock said, "Well, of course we'll use that music." And being a friend of Hitch's, Benny reportedly said, "But I thought you didn't want any music." to which Hitchcock said to the 49-year-old Herman, "Improper suggestion, my boy." So, and that was the only film that Hitchcock really, I think, went out of his way to give Herman a lot of credit for in interviews. He fully acknowledged the importance of music in that film's success, just as Orson Welles once said that half of Citizen Kane's success was due to Herman's score. We can debate the percentages, but certainly great filmmakers knew what music could do for their movies.
Yeah, man, I'm thinking about, I'm going to go off on a tear, so I better stop myself. I'm thinking about the theremin in The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, yeah.
And the xylophone to indicate the skeletal bones in, is that
Seven Voyages to Sinbad?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Man.
And Jason the Argonauts.
I'm thinking about the theremin is actually one of my favorite Bernard Herrmann albums. I have to say.
Wasn't that a Charlie Kaufman film this year?
Absolutely. I'm thinking about it. Absolutely it was.
So, John, having now met Jerry Goldsmith, you went on to tick off, I'm sure, in your mental checklist, so many, many others. And you're right up to date because you cover the film music scene. You have for many years for Variety and for other publications. And I think just as important, you teach film music. You teach at USC's Thornton School of Music here in Los Angeles. What kind of response do you get from your students relating to the classic era of film music?
Well, it's been interesting. You know, I started out teaching just in the scoring program, which is where young composers who actually already know how to write music want to get into the film part of the business. And then I sort of branched out and I started teaching a layman's version of the course that anybody could take. And it's been pretty interesting. I'm back now just teaching in the scoring program because I have a lot of other things on my plate at the moment. But what I find is that there's a tendency to think that film music sort of started with Star Wars in 1977. Now, yes, we can all laugh about that, but the whole Jaws and Star Wars mid-70s blockbuster period, which of course John Williams was you know, knee deep in, remains a kind of cultural touchstone for an entire generation of people. What has been sort of heartwarming for me is to be able to demonstrate that, in fact, the Williams approach to those films and many others actually was rooted in the kinds of things that Max Steiner and Eric Wolfgang Korngold and Alfred Newman and, of course, Bernard Herrmann sort of created the foundation for decades earlier. So I really love doing that. I mean, teaching, it sort of came up as an accident, you know, but you'll probably remember Leonard Buddy Baker, who was the great Disney composer of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, was running that program. And he called me in the 90s and said, "You know, we've got an opening here. We need somebody to come and talk about the history of film music. Do you want to do this?" And I said, "I guess." I didn't know. It's turned out to be one of the most rewarding parts of my career, is introducing this great music and as Jesse said, the soundtrack of our lives throughout the 20th century to so many young people.
Well, that, I really feel that my dad was meant to be a teacher in the way that I feel you were meant to be a teacher. And what's important, and this is, I would say, the through line for our friends in general, extremely passionate, energetic people who are excited to share. And so to me, being a teacher makes the most sense, because as much as we can all sit and go, how do you people not know this, that doesn't actually solve anything. Right. You know, being annoyed, people will come up to us all the time and they'll say, you know, I've never seen a Citizen Kane. You can go through the list. And I always say, look, it's really daunting when someone continually tells you this is the best thing ever. And then you sit down and how are you watching it? Are you at home? Is it, big screen, small screen, whatever. People need context.
Yes.
And they need to be taught. And so, not everybody is going to conduct a large orchestra and score films. But at the very least, you tell your students you want to make them smarter moviegoers.
And in fact, something very similar is what I try to tell my students, which is when you finish this semester, I want you to be able to go to the movies and listen more carefully and understand music is doing while you're watching the film. You'll be a better moviegoer, a more informed moviegoer, simply for the experience of understanding the role and power of music and image.
How did you hit upon the idea of doing a book on the music of James Bond?
Well, that's a tale in itself, not unlike Stephen's about the Herman book, which is I was always a big fan of John Barry. And I made his acquaintance at the time of Dances with Wolves around 1990, and then began to interview him occasionally when a piece would come up, whether for The Hollywood Reporter or Variety or the LA Times. And I had been approached by a publisher in the early 2000s about this topic. Would you be interested in doing a book on the music of James Bond? And I knew that in the early 2000s, John Barry scored 11 of the Bonds, including virtually all the early ones. Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, From Russia With Love. These are all great John Barry scores. But I knew that John's memory was failing as he was nearing his 70s. And I thought, I really don't want to tackle this topic if John can't really remember the important things that I would need to put in the book. So I turned it down. But then he died in early 2011. And I reconsidered because I thought, I know virtually everybody else involved in Bond music from the very beginning, including Monty Norman, the composer of Dr. No and the original Bond theme composer. And I thought, this would be a great opportunity to celebrate what John Barry did by essentially inventing a brand new kind of action adventure music for films, which he did in those Bond films of the 60s. And so I did tackle it. And in fact, it's our Stephen's same publisher, Oxford University Press, was kind enough to say yes to my Bond proposal. So I spent the summer of 2011 and poor Merrily listened to nothing but Bond music coming from my office for three straight months. But it was worth it. And I'm very proud of the book. It chronicles the entire history of Bond music dating back to 1962 and how it changed and evolved through the years. And the great stories associated with some of these great themes. How Michael Caine happened to be crashing at John Barry's flat the night he wrote Goldfinger. How Shirley Bassey was so outraged that she didn't get to sing a song in Thunderball that she sued the Bond producers and tried to stop the release of Thunderball from hitting. I just love all this stuff.
Well,
what was the event of the Academy? Who played the guitar?
Well, I was just going to say, you gave me a lifetime, me and about 1,000 other people,
right,
in the auditorium, a lifetime memory, which was sitting in the Samuel Goldwyn Theater on Wilshire Boulevard, the Academy's headquarters, in that beautiful theater, and playing on screen the first scene, essentially, of Dr. No. And in comes, you know, being in comes the audio of a guitar playing bum ba da bum 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 ba da bum bum, and then gradually we lose the soundtrack off the film, and a spotlight comes up on Vic Flick, the very guitarist who played it in 1962. what a moment!
And I still remember him coming home and going, "Oh my God!"
I'm proud to say that was my idea.
You can be proud of that.
Because I knew Vic, and he was in town, and he still had the guitar. And we had
the same guitar.
Oh, yes. And we had a backing track that had been recorded a few years earlier for an album that featured Vic on guitar. And Vic only had to add his guitar to the backing. So we had the backing track. So we played that, and Vic actually played it live. And it kind of brought the house down, didn't it, Leonard?
It sure did. It sure did.
Well, the first time, again, these names that for the folks where this is what you love, you know, some names seem like they should be the most famous, you know, people in the world, but I'll never forget, we saw Plas Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad says to me, Jess, yeah, you see that guy? Who, by the way, Plas Johnson looks just like the Pink Panther. Like, if you look at him and then you look at the Pink Panther, they are the same. But he plays saxophone. He plays that bit that we all know. Da 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 da. That's him, and it's again the look on my dad's face. It's always my favorite because normally it's me and my mom freaking out when we see people, but when it's music related, especially, my dad will full on elbow me in the throat to go, "Hey, it's Plas Johnson." You know, it's thrilling. It's thrilling,
and properly so.
Yes, and full credit, Henry Mancini, who wrote, of course, that theme. Continued to use Plas for years and years and years. And the people who revived the Pink Panther movies had the brains and the savvy to rehire Plas Johnson.
That's right. I remember interviewing Chris Beck when he did that first remake with Steve Martin of the Pink Panther. And one of the first things he said was, Plas Johnson is here. We have to use him. And they did.
At least they did something right.
That's right.
Stephen, your newest book is on the man who you call the father of film music, and I think it's not an exaggeration. Max Steiner kind of is the source.
Yes, I certainly would agree that he is a source. I actually, to be honest, I avoided the phrase the father of film music because that's what he keeps being called. And that makes him sound about as interesting as George Washington to a seventh grader. No offense with to your choice of phrase, but it is so, I think that is how we've all heard Max Steiner described as long as we've ever heard of Max Steiner, the father of film music or the dean of film music by very, you know, well-meaning and not inaccurate people. He was really the first to bring all the elements together. But when I was asked to write the Steiner biography about 5 years ago by our mutual friend, Gary Giddens, to whom you introduced me, Leonard, I discovered You're that welcome. Max, yes, for that and so many others, I discovered that Max was far more than just the guy who put together all of the different ingredients that were floating around in the various ways that people had scored movies since the movies began. But he was this fascinatingly energetic, spry. I know that the great Warner Brothers producer called him, Hal Wallace called him an energetic gnome, I think. But maybe that's a little unfair, but he was one of these short people talking with a cigar hanging out of his mouth and making lots of puns and bad jokes. And he was a gambling addict and he had multiple marriages and he wrote over 200 film scores himself in pencil all night without sleeping. And he was such a vital, life-loving person, certainly flawed, and the book gave me a chance to go into those things, but flawed in a very, I think, understandable and human way, that Max just, for me, as much as Bernard Herrmann, just pulses with real life and human emotion, both in the life that I was lucky enough to document, and in his music, which is certainly very different from Bernard Herrmann's approach. Herrmann was someone who was born in 1911, was in his 20s in the Depression, and was a colleague of Aaron Copland, and they grew up writing the very, very American music, which was more spare, less of that kind of Wagnerian big orchestral sound. And the Max Steiners and Eric Wolfgang Korngolds, both of those great composers, grew up in Austria and were very influenced by the 19th century concert music world that surrounded them. So was Bernard Herrmann. He just moved away from it to some degree. But when Max, after spending 20 or so years in Vienna, you know, thinking he was going to be an operetta composer, then suddenly his family went bankrupt and he had to flee to London and start over. He became a conductor of musical revues and thought, maybe, well, I'll write stage shows. And then World War I broke out and he had to flee that country and start all over again and move to a country that wasn't in the war.
Dodging creditors.
Oh, dodging creditors, yes. And I found him using a lot of pseudonyms, and I think that speaks to how much his father owed money around the world. And I should say before we leave his childhood that Max's father, Gabor, was sort of forgive me, Leonard, he was in a little bit like the Walt Disney of Austria in that 60 years before Disneyland, Gabor Steiner, Max's father, created this vast amusement park in Vienna called Venice in Vienna. That was this recreation of Venice, Italy, filled with gondolas in canals and palazzos that actually, if you walked inside, were beer halls or symphony concert rooms or wrestling matches. There were roller coasters in the background. His father put in the great Ferris wheel that we know from movies like The Third Man. So, as far as my research could tell, Gabor put in the first movie theater in Vienna months after the Lumiere brothers had shown their films in Paris. Wow. So Max literally grew up. He was 8 years old, you know, I think when all this was happening, he grew up in this playground that looked ahead to the 20th century. And the only thing that was bigger than his father's ambitions were his debts. So yes, Max had to flee the country, flee two countries. And fortunately, one country that wasn't involved in World War I was America. So he landed in New York, started over from the bottom. And by 1929 was one of the top he was one of the top conductors and musical directors on Broadway, working with Gershwin and Kern and Oscar Hammerstein and Victor Herbert and everyone. And he was just like Bernard Herrmann, who was Orson Welles' music director and radio at the time that RKO said, "Hey, Orson, want to come make a movie in Hollywood?" And Orson said, "Yes, and I'm bringing my musical director." That's how Benny scored Citizen Kane. Much in the same way, Max had just worked his way up to the top again on Broadway when talkies became the official coin of the realm movie making in Hollywood in 1929. And William LeBaron of this young studio RKO said, "Mr. Steiner, come out and do some orchestrations for us. We need composers. We're building a music department." And I think it's important for people to realize that until the talkie era, studios did not have music departments. They might have musicians who came on a silent film stage to play a little bit of mood music for a Gloria Swanson or someone, or a D.W. Griffith film. But it wasn't until Max that the whole notion that lives today of complete music departments at studios really came about. And Max came to Hollywood in the final days of 1929. He left Broadway just as the stock market crashed with incredible good fortune and with months of being an orchestrator at RKO. And that's the person who takes a composer's parts and sort of breaks them up into the individual instrumental parts. Within months of being hired for a rather lowly job, he was made head of the music department. And 3 years later, wrote the score for King Kong. And the rest is history.
I love, beyond my words to express, the last two bars or so of King Kong, where the music is ascending. Da, yes. Da, da, and you think it's going da 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 da. No, it goes da 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 da.
Yes.
Twice. He goes back to go for an extra punch, extra musical punch. As this majestic movie comes to a close.
Yeah.
I played that track over and over and over.
It's a great score. And one thing that was fun to discuss in my book is it was not the first orchestral score for a big Hollywood movie. People often say, oh, that was the first movie to have an orchestral film score. It was not. It's just that it's the oldest great movie that people remember that has a score. And it is the first, I would say it's the first great film score written in the sound era of Hollywood. But what was so fun to discuss in my book was the fact that after spending 2 years at RKO trying to convince producers and studio executives to allow him to put underscoring under dialogue for their movies and being unable to because producers kept saying, Max, won't people wonder where the music is coming from? As if they hadn't heard music during silent films for 25 years. Well, Max finally was able to write the kind of scores we think of today as a movie score when RKO hired a new production chief named David O. Selznick, then in his 20s. And Selznick said to Max, I love music too. Let's try this. Let's put music in the movies. And for the very busy year of 1932, Selznick and Steiner worked together, putting one movie together after another with a really terrific original score by Steiner. My favorite is The Most Dangerous Game, which was sort of the warm-up act for King Kong. And so Max, at age, you know, he came to Hollywood when he was 41 after living all these different lives in many different continents. That's why I dared to call my book The Epic Life of Hollywood's Most Influential Composer. He worked in Africa. He worked in Europe. He went to Russia. He went everywhere, and he ended up in Hollywood. And it was really Selznick who empowered Max, who gave him the authority to write what we might think of as a John Williams type of film score. And I love that Star Wars is such a touchstone because not only was there some Max Steiner music on the temp track when George Lucas and the editors were trying to convey to people what they wanted it to sound like, but John Williams was mentored by Bernard Herrmann, and Herrmann had died about a year before Star Wars was made, and Williams, as an homage, sneaks in one little theme from Psycho in the score of Star Wars as our heroes are in the Millennium Falcon and it's landed on the Death Star and they all pop out secretively. We hear the Bernard Herrmann Madhouse theme from Psycho, and Williams told me he did that as a nod to someone who had really shown him so much the way of how to do things. So both Max and Benny, and Benny was what he was called by his friends, Mr. Herrmann, did so much to pave the way. And I think that's why these books do have relevance for people. We were talking about younger people not knowing the history. Well, that's okay. But the history is relevant. And I love Leonard and Jesse and John, the way you all instill in people a love of movies and give them the guideposts in.
Well, there's a through line. There's a through line to all of this. And that's what I find always endlessly fascinating, is identifying that through line. Mm. And not just for young people, but even for myself, realizing, coming to understand that, one thing follows another for a purpose, for a reason.
Yeah.
John, when you were working on your TV themes, TV's biggest hits, could you have envisioned a time when TV themes would almost disappear, when there'd be themes like the Law and Order theme.
Dum dum. But it is fascinating how things come in and out of popularity. It is mind blowing. There was a point in the 90s where every single Disney film had an R&B version over the credits of one of the songs from the film. It was inevitably Vanessa Williams and someone else, but it happened every single time. And in the last few years, they started doing it again, where they brought in Demi Lovato to sing something in Frozen over the credits. But if you remember watching these movies, they all had these fairly ridiculous R&B versions at the end over the credits. And that was the thing. That's what you did. Now, I think about all the shows where they either don't have anything. Billions just sort of goes, ah, and that's it. And then on Netflix and most of the other streaming channels, you can skip the intro.
Oh man, don't get me started about that. I mean, there's an English composer named Daniel Pemberton who has just done the Trial of the Chicago 7. He has started a campaign to try and get Netflix to stop this end credit disappearing act. respect.
Yeah.
Because there are so many people and a lot of musicians who don't get the credit unless you actually see the credits roll. Anyway, to go back to your question, Leonard, I wrote the book in 1995, the TV book, which was really designed to be a history of television scoring that wound up inevitably just focusing on the themes because there were so many of them that you couldn't really talk about, 200 shows without primarily focusing on the themes. I did it in part because that business of the disappearing main title, those 30, 40, 60 seconds of opening music that we all grew up with in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was starting to go away. Seinfeld didn't really have a very memorable theme. Jonathan Wolf would kill me if he heard that. But Frasier just...
But it's memorable, but it's brief.
And it's intertwined with Jerry's monologue at the beginning of every episode. And in the case of Frasier, you just had that sort of 5-second jazz lick that sort of opens the show. So TV themes were beginning to go away. And the reason for that, it was really started at ABC in 93, that this campaign to get rid of main titles, because the great fear of the networks was people are switching channels. Yeah. Don't give them an excuse to switch the channel. Yeah. They've seen that main title already. They don't need to see it every week. And so it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. But then, interestingly enough, the reason I'm revising it now, 25 years later, is that streaming services, as often as in terms of Jesse, you're pointing out the fact that sometimes there's just no theme or it's very brief or you can skip that intro. They have also provided an opportunity for some composers to actually have a great main title. House of Cards by Jeff Beal is 1.5 minutes, for example. And I'm not one of those people who, pushes the button and says, skip the main title. I watch whatever the show is, because I want to experience what filmmaker and composer both wanted us to experience, which is find our way into that world, not just image-wise, but also musically, because the composer's job is to set it up and to create a world, a soundscape for us that will be unique to that place and that time. And the music is an integral part of that. Anyway, I'm preaching again.
You're preaching to the choir. It's all right. We're with you.
We're rooting you on. Yeah.
So yes, I'm revisiting the book now. I'm nearly finished with it. And again, Stevens and my publisher, Oxford, is going to put it out. And I'm excited about it because the original book, which you have, thank you, Leonard, went out of print quickly. People didn't buy it. And I never liked the title, frankly, and didn't come up with that. And so we're doing a brand new version that expands all of the chapters, rewrites much of it, and it includes a great deal of new material covering the last 25 years of television.
Wow.
That's exciting.
John, it went out of print because I bought all the copies and gave them.
Thank you for that.
But again, it is just fascinating how things go in and out of popularity. And the way that films reflect and TV reflects it directly. It's not, when the TV show Community first came on, I remember, this is a weird tidbit, but they had the shortest intro at that point ever. It was the shortest intro that existed. And I remember people talking about that. They said, yeah, they just want to get right into it. I said, okay. But and it's a cute little intro. If they're unraveling, you can't unravel paper. They're uncrumpling a piece of paper, and that's where the things are coming from. Mm-hmm. At the same time, because my dad has always loved credits, both the beginning and the end, that's something I watch. So I love when we go to the movies and it has a brilliant opening. Yeah. TV shows as well. But there are two things go in cycles. So for a while, everything was food. Everything was mustard spelled out the director's name. and then that mustard ended up on a skateboard that went down a hallway that opened a locker. And in the locker on the bottom were socks that spelled out someone else's. It's like they find a thing and they go, okay, this is the thing we do. You know, some people tried to copy what Cameron Crowe did in Almost Famous. I don't know if you remember it, but he was writing their names in pencil and he erases. That became a thing for a while. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, as I say, I'm mesmerized by all of these pieces. And also how soundtracks have once again, because people love records again, that's a thing that you're into, suddenly you're getting actual records.
Yay. I love
how
that.
How cool is that? Thanks, guys.
But no record yet that we know of for the Queen's Gambit, which has a fantastic.
Funny you should mention that. Yes, me too. And even though, unfortunately, you're given the option to skip them, I was going to say, is at the time of recording, two of the most popular things on TV right now are The Crown and The Queen's Gambit, and they both have terrific scores and great main titles, main titles, themes and sequences. And I hope that brings the trend back around.
Yeah,
and I think there will be an album of music from The Queen's Gambit. The composer is a lovely guy named Carlos Rafael Rivera, who is based in Miami. And he's done so well in a very short period of time, and clearly is, I think, going to be a force to be reckoned with as years go on.
That's one of our favorite things is we'll all watch something and my dad will say, oh, did you hear that recording of Yeah, it was so good. That's one of my favorites. You know, especially being younger, it's exciting for me when someone unknowingly enjoys a Duke Ellington recording. You know, I like it when someone, you know, they didn't mean to listen to this great jazz song, but whoops, here it is. And later on, I can say, you know, there are more.
That's
not
right.
But there are more.
And right up the Malton Alley, I might add, is some new material that I've discovered with regard to the TV themes that Count Basie and Duke Ellington and Dave Brubeck wrote for shows between 1958 and 1964. I mean, even Duke Ellington wrote a TV theme, even though almost no one knows that. So I'm excited.
Let me see how my trivia brain, my... Dave Brubeck wrote the one, was it called Mr. Broadway?
Mr. Broadway, 1964, that's right.
It's all in there somewhere, man.
Yeah. And Count Basie did M Squad.
That's right, in 58.
Yeah, but I don't know the Ellington.
Duke Ellington, MGM convinced Duke Ellington to come in with his band and score the pilot of the short-lived series called The Asphalt Jungle in 1960 with Jack Warden.
And it didn't last.
So. It didn't last. 13 weeks and out.
What's the Frankie Lane one that you love?
Rawhide.
It's Rawhide.
Yes.
Although Frankie Lane also sang another Dimitri Tiomkin theme for Gunslinger, which also only lasted 1 year on CBS.
If you've never heard, he probably won't do it now, but if you've never heard my dad do the Rawhide theme song, let me tell you.
Well, I think now's the time.
I was going to say, no better time. No better time.
Go into it.
No, but on another occasion, perhaps. I don't have my whip here.
You don't have your whip. He does like sound effects.
Well, it's not complete without me.
Thank you. Oh, man. How long have you all known each other?
Oh, my gosh.
I think it's 30 years. What do you think?
I think it's around that because I started commuting here to work on Entertainment Tonight in the spring of 1982. And then Alice and I moved in November of 83, which to my astonishment is 37 years ago. How is that possible? But it is possible. So it's within that time frame. And
so, Stephen, I think you and I met in 89 or 90.
Yes.
Through David Kraft.
Yes, through our late dear friend David Kraft. And Leonard, I'll always remember the day I met you because I was just a few months into the Herman book and had wormed my way onto some industry screening lists of things. And I remember saying to myself, that's Leonard Maltin sitting behind me. And I met you and a gentleman named Todd McCarthy. And then 6 years later, you were kind enough to invite me to be on Entertainment Tonight for a Bernard Herrmann segment. And I remember thinking, I've written this book. I was just interviewed by Leonard Maltin. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? It's over.
Well, I could still do an interview like that if I were still working for Entertainment Tonight, and if your last name happened to be Kardashian.
For once, I'm grateful that it's a Smith. But, and since we're saying how there are things about film and TV music that make us a little sad these days, I will say that at least pre and hopefully post COVID, one wonderful thing is the fact that you don't that film music isn't treated like this stepchild of music anymore. Because when the Max Steiners and Bernard Herrmanns were alive, they were really looked down upon, and they weren't invited to conduct their music at public concerts, and people really treated them very poorly. Both Max and Benny conducted the New York Philharmonic for their sort of Hollywood Bowl-like summer season at Lewison Stadium. They were each invited once, and they were treated so shabbily by the musicians that they never wanted to go back. Now, ironically, many symphony organizations around the world are staying in business because they are conducting live scores of classic films like Casablanca and Psycho being two of the most popular, with the film being shown behind them. And while it may not always be the most successful way to present those movies, I just love the fact that orchestras have acknowledged, whether it's I think sometimes it's of course it's purely out of financial necessity, but musicians have always, I think many musicians have loved film music, and you have a generation now. And Jesse, hopefully you grew up not thinking that movie music and TV music was anything to look down on, right? It was.
Oh my God, are you kidding? No, yeah. That's we love all of it, and I mean again, I have trouble sometimes. I don't know about other people because obviously my upbringing was different. And I did see a lot of live performances.
And vive la différence.
So that's, I try to understand what it would be like if I didn't. But at the same time, so my dad has always loved jazz. And thusly, I have always loved jazz. And the fact that Betty Boop and cartoons like that had that kind of music in it, I thought was the coolest thing ever. You know, Cab Calloway already looks like a cartoon. Yes. So it wasn't a physical transition, you know. And so definitely the things that you hear certain things and it puts you in a certain place. And I'm a music lover. That was easy. That was the one thing that I immediately fell in love with and was good at. The only thing that I did well
not
at.
True, not true.
No, in school, if I hadn't been in the arts, I don't know what would have happened. They kept me because I was useful. We love music in our house is constant. It's necessary. Yeah.
And now I have the three little bops in my head for some reason.
And why not? And
that's
why
right.
See, it's, again, timing in life is everything. I got to meet and know Stan Freberg, who does performs. I got to meet and really got to know Stan Freberg, who performs that soundtrack, and Friz Freleng, who created the cartoon.
Oh, man.
Little Bops.
Yeah.
A wonderful Warner Brothers one shot.
We listened to see all the... When we start talking about Stan, I start laughing. All of it plays in my head and I start laughing. And unfortunately, some of his songs, similar to Forbidden Broadway, have ruined my ability to listen to certain songs because it's all you hear. The one that always comes to mind is, if you've never heard Somewhat Overindulgent, which is their Mandy Patinkin song, sung to Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Somewhat overindulgent. It's ridiculous and wonderful. And
I just want to see. What's that, Leonard?
There are many others. Yeah, there's so many.
I just want to say, anyone listening, Jesse has a perfect sense of pitch, and I've never heard you sing so much.
Yeah.
I want this to be a recurring feature on the podcast.
Oh, so she's got a wonderful voice. She's got a wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
I had... But timing is great. I got to meet David Raxon. I didn't get to know him terribly well, but I had a lovely time with him, many spirited conversations. And the one time I went to his house to interview him with a crew from ET, and I lingered afterwards to just ask things I was interested in, we were talking about this and that, and I've gone over his filmography pretty well. He said, I mentioned something about cartoons. He said, well, I did some cartoons. I said, well, yeah, I know about the UPA cartoons you scored in the early 50s. And UPA was a revolutionary studio that like staffed all by ex-Disney people, but ex-Disney people who wanted to go in a different direction, visually and story-wise, and even musically. He said, no, not just that. You know, I did a couple of George Powell puppet tunes. I said, you did? Like what? He said, well, I did Dipsy Gypsy. I said, you did Dipsy Gypsy? Who's playing the swing violin on that? Is that Joe Venuti? He said, no, I think it was Harry Bluestone. I'm having this conversation with a man in 1986.
And you are just as excited about it right now.
Yes. Right. And he said, he's starting to think about different things. I was even in a soundie. You were in a soundie? Which one? Well, I did one where I conducted the orchestra for Cliff Edwards. You were in the Cliff Edwards soundie? Where are you going to have
Oh, great.
Discovery.
Yeah. And speaking of David, before we leave David Raxton, I have to say, John, please tell us the role that David Raxton played in a memorable day in your life.
Well, it was in 1998, and none of my family was able to come out for our wedding. And so Marilee and I were fairly close to Raxton at that point in our lives and careers. And so Mr. Raxton walked me down the aisle at my wedding.
Oh, how wonderful.
So, yeah, how wonderful. It was memorable, a memorable evening. Raxton was great. He was the smartest composer I think I ever met. He was so articulate, so thoughtful, so well-educated. Completely. And in many ways, I think that sort of ruined his career because he was so smart that he tended to let directors know that he was really smarter than they were in most cases. And I don't think that did his career much good in the 60s. But what a thrill it was to be able to walk into a studio and to talk with him about Laura and Forever Amber and The Bad and the Beautiful. And he was just never less than fascinating to talk to.
True. He also taught me a valuable English lesson. I was interviewing him on stage at the Palace Theater downtown on Broadway during the Last Remaining Seats series, which is a wonderful annual event here in LA where the Los Angeles Conservancy takes over the
one of the great old movie
palaces and shows a classic film. So they were showing Laura, and he wrote the famous theme and the score for that. And I said, so is it true that it was months after you wrote that song that Johnny Mercer said a lyric to the pre-existing melody? And he looked at me and he said, well, I hope it wasn't a post-existing melody, Leonard.
Never again.
I looked him straight in the eye. I said, David, I will never use the word pre-existing again. And I've been on a one-man campaign ever since to eradicate it from the vocabulary.
That is so classic Raxton.
It's a redundancy. Existing. Yeah. All you have to say is
it exists.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's great that old Hollywood could find a place for people like David Raxton and especially a Bernard Herrmann, who would absolutely explode into a tirade with a major producer or a major director in front of lots of people. Somehow they were allowed in the system, and it's because they had very strong music directors in those days. At Fox, they had Alfred Newman, and he was, I think, really the shield who protected Raxton and Herrmann and others. And it's in an age now when, of course, 10 people have their say on music. Back in the 40s, let's say, very often the musical director was the primary person who would talk to the composer about what the score was going to be. And sometimes the director wasn't even involved. I remember when I was researching the Bernard Herrmann book, I got the number for Henry Hathaway, and the great director of so many films. If you're listening, you probably know some of them. True Grit was a late film. And he had directed two films that Herrmann scored. And I said, something like, what are your memories of Bernard Herrmann? And he said, Bernard Herrmann, I remember meeting him at a party once. And that was his way of saying, in those days, we didn't talk to the composers. He was shooting Kiss of Death or whatever his next movie was by the time Benny was scoring his film.
So, Stephen, that brings me to ask you about Casablanca. I always assumed that Steiner would work primarily with Hal Wallace, but did he also work with Michael Curtiz?
He did to an extent. There was in writing my Max Steiner book, and I was lucky that all of Max's papers, his pencil scores, his recordings, and he was one of the only composers who kept the actual recording sessions going back to like 1931, outtakes and all. Most of them, you know, many of them were saved by a wonderful archivist named James Dark, who deserves a lot of credit. Hero, yes. And but when Max became a staff composer at Warner Brothers, and Max Steiner wrote the famous Warner Brothers logo fanfare, he would work primarily with the producer, but he did work with Michael Curtiz. Michael Curtiz was his favorite director, I think, that he ever worked with, because he loved to say that a Michael Curtiz film, he was made for music. That was Max's favorite phrase. And I think he meant by that, that it breathed, that music could, that you know, music could help you understand what a character was feeling. But Hal Wallace was the very hands-on producer of Casablanca. And fortunately, there survives at USC the original music notes that Hal Wallace wrote. And Leonard, I know you wrote a magnificent article on mostly this, focusing mostly on the source music of Casablanca that is in your book Hooked on Hollywood that everyone should own and read. But we looked at those same notes by Hal Wallace, and Hal Wallace wrote very detailed what they called spotting notes of where he wanted music. And he would write things like, as Rick sits drunk in Rick's cafe and begins, as we hear the flashback, Sam's piano playing as time goes by, goes into an orchestral version with strings. I might be exaggerating slightly, but Hal Wallace had a very strong sense of what he wanted musically. The only thing that Hal Wallace and Max didn't agree on that movie was the song As Time Goes By. And I have to say that Max Steiner was a genius who was happy to incorporate other people's themes into his scores, but he hated the song As Time Goes By, which was a virtually forgotten song in 1942. It was in a flop Broadway show of 1931. It wasn't the pop standard we know today. And Max had just, and I mean weeks earlier, just finished scoring Now Voyager, for which he wrote the beautiful theme that became the popular song, It Can't Be Wrong. And when Max saw Casablanca without score, he fell in love with Ingrid Bergman the way many a composer falls in love with the leading lady or leading man or whoever in the film. And he really wanted to write an original love theme for that Rick and Ilsa romance. So, and yes, he would love to have written a song that would generate a pop music hit and sheet music sales and help him get out of the debt he was in, but that's another story. But it was primarily creative. And Hal Wallace, to his everlasting credit, said, Max, you are using As Time Goes By. I've listened to you four times in a row, you know, and you were done talking about it. And they were very, very, I have to say, for a tough studio, solicitous and very supportive of Max Steiner. He got what he wanted for many years there because they knew what a movie was like before he scored it and after he scored it. And I found stacks of telegrams from toughies like Wallace and Jack Warner saying, thank you, you saved this movie. Mm-hmm. But on Casablanca, Max really used As Time Goes By under duress. That said, as soon as he realized that he had to use it, you would think that not only did he love it, but that he had composed the song. He creates so many gorgeous variations of it in the music. And it's a sign of Max's great sense of humor that in his pencil score of Casablanca, the notes he's writing for his orchestrator, Hugo Friedhofer, on the last page, he writes, Dear Hugo, thank you very much. I'm very happy with you. Yours, Herman Hupfeld. the composer of As Time Goes By. So Max had a great sense of humor. And then, of course, 5 minutes later, he was on to the next movie he was scoring at Warner Brothers.
Well, we could go on like this for a long, long time. But I think we'll end this chapter.
Yeah.
This chapter. Who says we're not going to reopen the chapter and write new chapters in the book ahead? Guys, are you social mediaites?
Well, sadly, yes.
Happily, yes. Happily, yes.
When I had to put together a website, I grew up as you did, Leonard. I think, and Stephen, I think to a certain degree, you too. We all grew up in a print era where, as reporters, we weren't expected to promote our work. But today everything is about self-promotion. So I when I created a website, my web designer said, well, obviously you need to be on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, he to date has not pushed me on Instagram, but I suspect will any day now. And so, yeah, we're there. So
what is it, John? What is your website?
It's www.johnberlinggame.com.
No H.
No H. Correct. Thank you. J-O-N.
And I have a website, mediastephen.com. That's Stephen with a V, mediastephen.com.
Because V goes V, not F.
Yes. Well said.
Well, guys, it's been a ball. And I so value your friendship and your scholarship as well.
Well, you have been a leitmotif in my life for a very long time, and so have you, Jesse, whether you knew it or not. So thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
And we love you guys dearly. Thank you for having us on.
I miss you. I miss Marilee, and I really hope we get to see you before 2030.
Yeah, I hope we all get to see each other.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Indeed.
And thank you.
You can find us.
On the couch.
Well, if we don't happen to be sitting on the couch.
Fair. I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we're also on Patreon.
Maltreon.
If people feel the urge to support what we're doing.
There is great Malton stuff on Patreon, I have to say. We were just discussing that before the show, and I won't tell anyone what it is. You have to subscribe.
My dad does a monthly newsletter, and then he does a memorabilia piece. He talks about one of his collectibles, and we have a lot of fun.
Have fun doing this. That's patreon.com/MaltonOnMovies. And thank you all, and thank you guys. We'll see you next week.
Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.